Welcome back, True Crime Army. I am your host, Margot, and this is Military Murder, a show where I focus on crimes committed by military members and veterans. But don't worry, you don't have to know anything about the military to listen, I promise. You just have to be a true crime enthusiast, and if that's you, welcome home. Hi, everyone. So I am finally back from my three-week military tour, and I had an amazing time. I always take this time when I have to go serve my time in person to get re-blued, because even though I have a podcast about military true crime, I absolutely love the military, and I really believe that I wouldn't be where I am today without them. I've never told you this, but I joined the military, or maybe I did tell you, but I joined the military for college money, and I was blessed enough to go through ROTC, and my college was funded with Air Force money, my resident assistant stipend, and a few academic scholarships. So yeah, I owe a lot of what I've become to the military. And I do want to take this opportunity to say that regardless of the content of this podcast and, you know, the fact that it's true crime, I would pick to stay on a military installation over the civilian sector any day of the year. Honest to goodness, while I am always still aware of my surroundings when I'm in the military base, there is a certain sense of security when you're just around comrades. But of course, what I always say, awareness makes you a better person. So thank you so much for joining me for today's story. Today, I am taking you back a few decades, where a woman was found dead outside a military base, a soldier received a bad conduct discharge for some unrelated misconduct, and where a foreign government still to this day believes that a former soldier is the perpetrator in a few of their decades-old cold cases. Join me today as I tell you about a little-known serial killer by the name of Paul DeRusso. Now, let's dig in.
Military Murder is an independent project and is not endorsed by the Department of Defense or any military component. The views expressed are those of the host. The content of this podcast is not meant to be legal or medical advice. Warning, this episode contains graphic details of murder and is not suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
As many of you know, in 2023, many of our military bases went through a renaming phase. Fort Benning was renamed Fort Moore in May of 2023. But for the purposes of this story, we'll use the name that it held back in 1997, Fort Benning. 26-year-old Tracy Habersham wasn't much for dating, but she loved to go dancing. It was one of her main sources of exercise, and she was in great shape just from dancing. On Friday, September 5th, 1997, Tracy decided she wanted to go out and dance. The Non-Commissioned Officer or NCO Club on nearby Fort Benning, Georgia seemed like the perfect place for her to go that night. Tracy didn't own her own car, so her brother picked her up and dropped her off at the front of the NCO Club, and he dropped her off like right around midnight. Before she got inside, Tracy ran into her old neighbor, Letitia Miles, who was on her way out of the NCO Club. The two friends chatted briefly about missing each other and how they should get together, and then Letitia left and Tracy entered the club. And that was the last time that Letitia would see her friend alive. Tracy's brother came back to the NCO club at around 2:45 a.m. to pick up his sister. Now, this was on September 6th, and so he's there to pick up his sister at the end of the night when NCO club is closing. But as people are trickling out of the door, he never sees Tracy. And by the time everyone's out, it seems like Tracy has vanished. On Sunday, September 7th, 1997, a woman was out walking her dog when she noticed a nude body of a woman lying in a ditch on Infantry Drive in Columbus, which is the city that borders Fort Benning. The body was later identified as Tracy Habersham. Witnesses that had been at the club that night, that Friday night, they reported that they saw her dancing with a very tall man sporting a box-shaped haircut. Investigators posted flyers and put up two billboards about Tracy's unsolved murder. They were hoping that this would lead to something, but nothing came up. Tracy, it turned out, had been strangled, cut on the ankle, and her tongue had been bitten. A heart-shaped ring that she had worn on her finger that evening was missing, and it looked like it had been ripped off of her finger. The DNA collected from her body was entered into CODIS, which is the U.S. Law Enforcement DNA database. but there was no match to any known perpetrators. 3 weeks into the investigation, the Columbus police had exhausted nearly all of the leads that they had. At that point, they announced a $5,000 reward, and they said that the $5,000 was given by Tracy's employer, Affleck. A spokesperson for Affleck later told the Ledger Inquirer that it was rare that the company offered cash rewards, but that Tracy was an exemplary employee, and she was well-liked by everyone she worked with. Affleck also donated 1,000 color copies of a reward poster to be distributed in the Columbus and Fort Benning area. Tracy had spent her whole life in South Columbus, and ironically, her body was found just blocks from her childhood home. Tracy graduated from Spencer High School in 1988 and received a degree in computer science from Clark Atlanta University in 1992. Tracy had stayed in Atlanta after graduating from college, and she left in spring of 1997 when she moved back home to Columbus to live closer to family. Tracy had told her neighbor in Georgia that she was planning on moving back to Atlanta the following spring because she had a lot of friends that she missed there. Police were perplexed. Tracy was, by all accounts, an upstanding member of the community. She attended church and managed her money well, and she didn't even drive. If she needed to go anywhere, she often took the bus or called her brother. She even lived within walking distance to her office, so she was always on time. But nothing stood out to investigators, and no one stood out as a possible suspect. By January of 1998, there were no arrests in Tracy's murder. It was the only homicide case out of 14 total that happened in 1997 that had no arrest, at least initially. And Tracy's case eventually went completely cold. On July 26, 1999, in Jacksonville, Florida, 24-year-old Tyresa Mack got her three children that were ages 7, 3, and 1.5. She got them ready for their day at Tina's Little Angels Daycare. At around 7:30 a.m., the children were picked up by the daycare's van, and shortly after, a family friend named Adam Moss stopped by to help Tyresa fix the lock on her front door. The apartment was one of two that were located above a shop. There was a locked door on the ground floor that led to a staircase, and then there were separate doors to the apartments. The upstairs entry door into Tyresa's apartment was the door with the broken lock. A little later in the morning, at around 9:30 a.m., Tyresa's friend Nicole Jackson showed up to pick up Tyresa so that they could go out job hunting. Adam went down the stairs to open the downstairs door and let Nicole in, and then he left. Tyresa and Nicole headed out at around 10 a.m., It turns out Adam wasn't able to fix the lock, so the ladies pushed the love seat against the door and left from the door in the kitchen. That day, Tyresa was wearing a black and white outfit. She paired it with two of her favorite jewelry pieces, an X&O necklace with a heart pendant and a matching bracelet. The two friends submitted a few applications and then they went to lunch at McDonald's before continuing their job hunt. It was hot outside that day, and since Nicole's car didn't have air conditioning, they decided to call it a day. They got back to Tyresa's apartment around 1 p.m., and that was where Nicole dropped off Tyresa at the front. Tyresa was tired and sweaty. Tyresa went back inside as her friend drove off. When Tyresa got inside, Tyresa called a different friend to see if she could get a ride for herself and one of her sons for a doctor's appointment that they had later that day. At about 1:25, the friend called Tyresa back and asked her to call her later in case she fell asleep. But Tyresa never called her friend back. The friend, of course, woke up from her nap and she tried to call Tyresa again. She tried at 2:50, but again, there was no answer. She tried to call her a bunch more times, but Tyresa never answered. Well, the friend didn't think too much of it. She figured, well, maybe Tyresa got another ride. Meanwhile, Sharabia Mack, which is Tyresa's sister, was getting worried, because Tyresa wasn't home when her kids were dropped off after school. The daycare had dropped Tyresa's kids off at their grandmother's house because mom wasn't home and they were too little to be by themselves. Sharabia knew that all three shouldn't be there. Tyresa was supposed to pick up one of her sons, Rodriguez, to take him to a doctor's appointment at 3 p.m. that afternoon, but she hadn't showed up to pick him up for his appointment, and then she wasn't home when the kids got home after school. Sharabia went to Tyresa's apartment at around 7 p.m. She tried the bottom door, but it was locked, so she rang the doorbell over and over and over again, But again, no one came to the door. Their grandmother's house was only about 3 blocks away, so Sharabia headed there. Sharabia then showed up back at Tyrese's house with her stepfather, Lamar. When they got back to the apartment that day, they found that the bottom lock was now unlocked, and they ran up to Tyrese's door and knocked. And if you recall, the lock was broken, but the ladies had pushed up a sofa. So, Tyrese's neighbor came out as the family was knocking, and he told them that he hadn't seen Tyrese since that morning. Sharabia and Lamar were worried. They knocked again and again, and when they didn't get a response, they broke down the door and shoved the sofa out of the way. Inside the apartment, it was quiet, and at first everything appeared fine. Nothing appeared out of place. That was until they got to Tyrese's bedroom. Her bedroom was normally clean and neat, but this day they found it in shambles. It had been ransacked and the drawers were pulled out and their contents had been dumped on the floor. And that was when they saw her. Tyrese was lying on her bed, dead. She was still wearing the shirt she had on that day from job hunting, but she was nude from the waist down. The pants that matched her shirt were on the bed near her body, as well as her purse that was emptied out. The jewelry that Tyrese wore that day was also missing. As they looked at Tyrese's dead body, they could see that there had been a white telephone cord that had been wrapped around Tyrese's neck. The family immediately called 911 and they waited there for the police. And when the police arrived and started processing the scene, they discovered Tyrese's underwear torn and underneath her body. They also noted that the telephone cord around her neck looked like it had come from the phone in the bedroom that had been torn off its base and was on the floor. And as the police were processing the apartment, Sharabia noticed that Tyrese's television was missing. She could actually see the outline of where the TV used to be because there was like a light coating of dust on the entertainment center. And that she pointed out to the cops. Crime scene technicians arrived to process the apartment. Other than the bedroom, they didn't find much out of order. Tyrese's apartment was described as clean and tidy. They noted a pink striped Victoria's Secret bag containing several bills on the floor of the bathroom, but it wasn't taken as evidence. Tyrese was actually known to use this as a purse slash wallet. Police interviewed neighbors to see if anyone saw or heard anything that day. Tyrese's neighbor, Joy Williams, said that she was waiting at the bus stop near the apartment when she saw a tall, thin, brown-skinned man with an Adam's apple that stuck out enough that she took note of it. Joy saw the man walking out of Tyrese's building with a television. She thought that he looked like he was in a hurry. She didn't continue watching him, like she didn't think he was doing anything bad, but she did see that he walked from the apartment to the trunk of a red four-door car with the TV. Another neighbor who was at the bus stop that day, Rufus Pinckney, he noticed the man too. He described this man similar to how Joy did. He said it was a tall, skinny, light-skinned black man, and Rufus also recalled what the man was wearing, a blue work uniform. Rufus saw the man come out of the bottom door of the building and walk to the trunk of a red car. Rufus saw the man open the trunk and then stand next to it for about 10 minutes. The man went upstairs, but Rufus didn't see him carrying anything, and he didn't think the man looked like he was in a hurry or trying to hide his face. Tyrese's body was taken to the medical examiner's office, and an autopsy was performed. They found abrasions on her nose, cheeks, lips, and tongue that the ME thought might have been a result of her face being pressed into a towel. The location of the abrasions on both sides of her face indicated that she was moving her head back and forth. Petechia was evident in the whites of her eyes. Petechia is caused by increased pressure and is a hallmark of being choked or strangled. The ME didn't find any indication that Tyrese was strangled, though. The telephone cord that was found around her neck was loosely looped around twice, kind of like a necklace, and it wasn't knotted. Tyrese's neck didn't have any injuries to it that could have been caused by the phone cord. In the ME's opinion, strangulation can still happen without evident trauma to the neck. Despite the lack of obvious injuries to her neck, the cause of her death was determined to be asphyxiation. Other injuries noted were ligature marks on Tyrese's arms and wrist. She was wearing a watch, but the ME couldn't tell if the bruise pattern on her wrist were from her watch or something else. Tyrese's top was torn in the middle, and her earrings were still on despite the injuries to her face that indicated that she had thrashed back and forth to get away from her perpetrator. A few months after Tyrese's murder, and they were still no closer to finding her killer. On December 17, 2002, high school student 18-year-old Nicole Williams was reported missing by her family. Her body was found the very next day on December 18th, lying in a ditch and wrapped in a blanket. The cause of death was listed as strangulation, and she had signs of being sexually abused. Police had zero leads as to who killed Nicole. And then, 2 weeks later, on January 1st, 2003, family of 19-year-old Nakia Kilpatrick thought that she had been unusually quiet. Her family hadn't heard from her for a few days, and it was causing them great concern. Nakia was a single mom to two little boys, so their worries weren't only for Nakia, but also for the two kids. Nakia's cousin Sarah lived in the same apartment complex as her. So on December 30th, Sarah walked by Nakia's apartment at 6 a.m. and noticed that there was a bedroom light on. She stopped by Nakia's door that evening and knocked, but there was no answer. But Sarah noticed an odd smell coming from the apartment. The next night, which was New Year's Eve, there was still no answer at Nakia's door. It wasn't like Nakia to go so long without talking to her friends. And plus, it was the holidays. Family often talk more during the holidays. Sarah went back with some family members that evening, just after midnight, and noticed the smell coming from the door was more pungent now. Sarah knocked again, and still no one answered. She went over to the window and started knocking very hard on it. She was trying to get Nakia's attention if she was in there, but Nakia never came to the window. Instead, her two-year-old son peeked through the window shades. When he opened them, Sarah could see Nakia and her 11-month-old baby boy laying on the floor in the hallway. The family now knew that Nakia needed help. They were able to get in through the door, and as soon as they walked through, they were blasted in the face by a putrid stench. I'm sure the sense of dread was as overwhelming as the smell of decay when they found her. Nakia was lying halfway in one of the bedrooms and half in the bathroom. Sarah immediately called 911 and got the police rolling to the apartment. Judging by the rate of decomposition, crime scene technicians estimated that Nakia had been dead for at least 48 hours. Those two little boys had been in the apartment for at least 2 days with their mother's dead body. Nakia's body was nude, she was bound, and a cable was around her neck. The drawers in her bedroom were all pulled out and clothes were scattered all over the floor. The apartment's front door had been locked, and the sliding glass door on the back of the house was closed and locked with the safety bar in place. These were the only entrances to the apartment, and there was no sign of a forced entry. An autopsy revealed that Nakia's cause of death was ligature strangulation. The cable was tied tightly over a pajama top around her neck with a slip knot. She had also suffered blunt force trauma that was focused on her head in three different places. Semen was present, but her body did not indicate vaginal trauma, although the ME noted that you don't always have bruising or tearing even if there's a forcible sexual assault. Swabs were taken for DNA testing. Sadly, at the time of her death, Nakia was 6 months pregnant. Less than 2 weeks after Nakia's decomposing body was found in her apartment, another woman named Shawanda McAllister was found slain in her apartment in a different area of Jacksonville, Florida. On January 9, 2003, Shawanda's body was discovered by her live-in fiancé. When the police arrived, they found Shawanda on the floor of her bedroom, naked from the waist down. A metal buckle was fastened to her right wrist and a cord was around her neck over a pink t-shirt. Her feet were bound with a black and white electrical cord. Her underwear was found on the floor in the bathroom and a condom was found in the bedroom on the opposite side of the bed from where her body was found. At autopsy, it was determined that Shawanda died of strangulation based on the petechia found in her eyes and abrasions found under the shirt and under the cord around her neck. Shawanda also had ligature marks on her wrist and bruising on her arms and forearms, and these were consistent with being bound. Shawanda had hemorrhaging at the base of her tongue as well. Her feet were tied with another piece of electrical cord, but there was no bruising underneath the cord indicating that her feet had been tied after she died. Just like Nakia, sadly, Shawanda was also pregnant at the time of her death. Now, as I was researching this case, I was a little bit unsure of the crime rate in Jacksonville, Florida at the time. And I know that Jacksonville is huge. But man, there are a lot of dead Black women in a short span of time. And the murders, it seemed, were about to pick up. On February 5th, two more dead young women were found in Jacksonville. 19-year-old Sarita Cohen and 17-year-old Giovanna Jefferson. They were discovered in a ditch next to a vacant lot. One of them had her hands bound behind her back and the other was covered in bruises. A construction crew was the one to call police when they discovered the first body while they were clearing the lot. The police located the second body 4 feet away from the first body when they began to investigate the scene of the first victim. Giovanna Jefferson had been attending Florida Community College working on getting her GED. She went missing on January 20th. Sarita Cohen was reported missing 10 days later on January 30th, and it was estimated that they both died on the day that they disappeared. So although they were both found together, they had been murdered at different times. Now, if you're keeping count, that's five bodies in the span of 2 months in Jacksonville. And the locals were beginning to get scared. Police were hard at work seeing if they could tie the victims to each other. And it turns out, during their investigation, one name kept coming up. Paul DeRusso. Paul DeRusso was a cab driver for Gator City Taxi. And wouldn't you know it, through the course of their investigation, they discovered that Giovanna and Sarita had last been seen with a cab driver on the nights they disappeared. As chance would have it, when investigators wanted to have a chat with Paul, he was closer than they anticipated, because he was locked up in the Duval County Jail. Paul had been arrested on February 6 on charges of pawning a stolen VCR and a parole violation from an aggravated assault conviction that he had from 2 years prior in 2001. Over the course of the next 4 months, the investigators slowly built a case against Paul. They were using cell phone records and cab records. But then, as the months ticked on, the DNA results from the five Florida cases were trickling in one by one, and Paul's DNA was at every single crime scene. It was a match. Paul DeRusso was born on August 11, 1970 in Beaumont, Texas. When he was a year old, he and his brother moved to L.A. to live with their mother and her family. Paul's first job after graduating from high school was as a security guard in 1989. In 1991, he was arrested for carrying a concealed weapon and received 3 years probation. Apparently, he didn't learn his lesson from that, so he did it again a month later and received the same charge. In 1992, to avoid having to marry a woman he got pregnant, Paul joined the army because what else do people do in the 90s to escape responsibility, right? Just kidding. While stationed in Germany with the army, Paul met his wife, Natoka Span. I'm pretty sure I butchered that name. Natoka was a fellow soldier. They married in Las Vegas in 1995 and went on to have 2 daughters together. The couple then PCS'd to Fort Benning, Georgia in 1996. And it was here that Paul began to show his true colors. Well, in 1997, Paul DeRusso was arrested and charged with kidnapping and raping an 18-year-old woman in Columbus. Army court-martialed Paul DeRusso and charged him with kidnapping, rape, and assault. But in the end, Paul was acquitted of all charges. Because Paul was acquitted, his DNA was not required to be put into the CODIS system. But Paul DeRusso would find himself at a court-martial again in January of 1999. This time, he stood charged with receiving stolen property and larceny of government property. In exchange for a plea agreement, Paul pled guilty to receiving stolen property and the other charges were dropped. As a result of the court-martial, Paul received a bad conduct discharge. After he was out of the Army, he and his family moved to Natoka's hometown of Jacksonville, Florida. But Paul had not given up his life of crime. In fact, 3 months after moving to Florida, Paul was arrested for molesting a 15-year-old girl. But for some reason, those charges were never formally filed. And Paul went under the radar again. A month later, Paul was arrested for trespassing and spent two nights in jail. In 2001, Paul was charged with raping a 19-year-old woman. For this crime, Paul was convicted for sexual battery, and he was sentenced to a whopping, hold your pants, people, 30 days in jail. Those days in jail were followed by 2 years of probation. Due to the nature of the crime, Paul was ordered to attend psychosexual counseling, and his DNA was finally entered into CODIS. By February of 2003, Paul was still on probation, and that's when he got busted when he tried to pawn the stolen VCR. But on top of that, his name kept coming up during the investigation of the two murdered teens found in the ditch, Sarita and Giovanna. Lieutenant Rick Graham, chief of Jacksonville Sheriff Department's homicide unit, said, quote, "Before that, the case was wide like the top of a funnel. Then we began to focus down on DeRusso," end quote. Upon searching Paul's house, investigators found a bedsheet with Giovanna's DNA on it. Inside Paul's vehicle, they found jewelry belonging to Sarita Cohen and Giovanna Jefferson, who, if you remember, were found by the construction crew in an empty lot in January. So it was through all the evidence found at Paul's house, his car, as well as through DNA, fiber analysis, and cab and call records in June of 2003, Jacksonville Sheriff's detectives had linked Paul DeRusso to all, I repeat, all five Jacksonville murders. With that, Paul was indicted by a grand jury for five counts of first-degree murder on June 29, 2003. Investigators knew that they were dealing with a serial killer, so they wanted to see if Paul could be linked to any other unsolved murders in the area. And that's when they linked him to the murder of Tyresa Mack. Remember, she was the mom of three who called a friend for a ride to her son's doctor's appointment. So investigators determined that Tyresa was also one of Paul's victims, making her victim number six in Jacksonville. There are conflicting news reports about what happened to Paul's wife, Natoka. I read that she left him and got a restraining order, but in other articles, she is quoted as saying that it would be hard to believe that her husband committed these crimes. And the direct quote was, quote, "If he did it, then by all means, he should be punished. But if he didn't, let him come home. He has a family here. Let us work out what we have to work out," end quote. Girl, you are married to a whole ass serial killer. What are you trying to work out? Really? Anyway, I also read some reports that said that Paul had been picked up for domestic violence against his wife. So she probably lived a life of domestic violence. On September 4th, 2003, Paul was formally charged in a separate formal accusation for the first-degree murder of Tyresa Mack. The prosecution announced their intention to pursue the death penalty in Tyresa's case. Meanwhile, so this is all happening in Florida. Well, Columbus, Georgia police, they obtained an arrest warrant for Paul as well. Excuse me, say what now? Yeah, remember Tracy Habersham who died after a night dancing at the NCO club at Fort Benning? Yup, Paul's DNA linked him to Tracy's murder. Huh. I'll be darned, wasn't our boy Paul stationed at Fort Benning when Tracy was killed? He sure was. And guess what? Her murder happened just weeks after Paul's acquittal for sexually assaulting and raping another girl. Let that sink in. So, just to recap, this means that Paul now stood accused of committing seven murders in 6 years, the first murder starting when he was still on active duty. Evidence gathered from Gator City Taxi showed that DeRusso used his cab to pick up at least three of his victims, 17-year-old Giovanna Jefferson, 19-year-old Nakia Kilpatrick, and 20-year-old Shawanda McAllister. With that, two lawsuits were filed against Gator City Taxi by the victims' families, but those civil lawsuits were put on hold pending the criminal proceedings. Now, we did search, but we couldn't find any resolution to those lawsuits. Records from Gator City Taxi showed that after Paul picked up Shawanda, which was the day she was killed, Paul didn't take another taxi call for 3 hours. When Giovanna was killed, Paul had a 7.5-hour gap from the time he picked her up until his next fare. Cell phone records showed that Paul had made and received calls from several women, including 18-year-old Nicole Williams, who was found in a ditch wrapped in a blanket the past December. The two had met on a telephone chat line and began what WFMY News 2 referred to as a relationship. At the time of this, quote, relationship, Paul was 32 years old, 14 years older than Nicole, who was still in high school. Records actually show that Paul only attended one mandatory psychosexual counseling appointment that he was ordered to complete after his conviction for assault in 2001. Instead of trying to get better, it turns out Paul was living a double life, cab driver and simultaneous cold-blooded killer. And I really don't understand this next thing that I'm about to tell you, so just bear with me. But prosecutors at this point, they made the decision to only pursue Tyresa's case in court. They felt that they had the best shot at the death penalty in her case, or at least putting him away for good. The charges against him for the other five Jacksonville murders were dropped because prosecutors had concern about how the appeals process could affect the cases. Now, what I think they were trying to do is they wanted to assure one conviction and then have maybe two separate trials. So if something went wrong on appeals, one of the convictions would still stick. So let's talk about the case involving Tyresa's murder. During that trial, the prosecution presented a nearly airtight case against Paul. That airtight case included DNA evidence, eyewitnesses who saw Paul at Tyresa's apartment on the day that she was killed. Well, at this trial, Paul took the stand in his own defense. He claimed, yeah, I met Tyresa and her kids when my kids had an appointment at the doctor's office. And so they were all there and that's how we met. Paul also claimed that they had like a little fling. He said that they had sex at least 7 to 10 times in her apartment. And on the day that she was killed, he was like, yes, I was at her apartment for consensual sex, duh. So what did he have to say about the television? Well, Mr. Paul DeRusso claimed that Tyresa told him that her TV was broken and that she had asked him to carry it out to the dumpster on his way out. But then she was like, well, you can keep it if you want. And of course, Paul wanted the TV, and that's why he put the TV in his car, which explains why people saw him carrying the TV. Paul played completely dumb. He was like, I did not kill her. She was alive and well when I left. He claimed that he didn't learn about Tyresa's death until a week after. But he also says he didn't call police because, quote, he didn't have any information to give them. When I left, she was still alive, end quote. Okay, like we haven't heard that before. Paul also claimed to have had consensual sex with Nakia Kilpatrick on December 29th, 2002. Paul said he was planning on staying the night with her, but another man arrived and was supposed to be grabbing Nakia that night. The big hero said that he was concerned for her safety, but left because Nakia was like, you can leave, I'm going to be fine. As with Tyresa's story, Paul claimed that he found out days later that Nakia had been killed. But again, quote, didn't know the circumstances of how she died or when she died, end quote. Same thing with Shawanda McAllister. Paul said he had consensual sex on January 9th, 2003 at her apartment after he picked her up in his cab. Paul claimed that her fiancé tried to come into the apartment via the window, so that's when Paul took his cue and left. When he returned, Shawanda was dead. This time, Paul claimed that he did call 911 the next morning, but didn't identify himself because he, quote, didn't want to get involved, end quote. Why would you call the cops if you don't want to get involved? I mean, this guy makes no sense. One of the defense tactics was a claim that Paul suffered from a congenital abnormality in that his arm span was 3 inches longer than his height. Now, this man, Paul DeRusso, stood at 6 feet, 6 inches tall. I don't know. So the defense is saying he has a congenital abnormality because his wingspan is 6 feet, 9 inches tall and he's 3 inches shorter. Anyway, the defense counsel also said that DeRusso's chest tapered too much towards the chest bone or towards the breastbone. The doctor testified, the defense's doctor, I'm assuming, that abnormalities like what he said Paul had are often paired with congenital brain abnormalities, other quote, defects, were a loss of brain function and brain damage, and the doctor also said that Paul could only read at a sixth grade level. Once the case was over, the jury had everything they needed in the bag for deliberations. On June 10th, 2007, the jury returned a verdict. They deliberated for more than 8 hours. They found Paul DeRusso guilty of the premeditated first-degree murder of Tyresa Mack. Other charges that he was convicted of were felony first-degree murder, sexual battery, and robbery. The penalty phase was scheduled for June 26. At the sentencing hearing, the jury returned with a 10-2 recommendation for lethal injection. And while most states with the death penalty back in 2007 required a unanimous death sentence, back in 2007, Florida was one of the three states that was like, nah, we good. Now, the judge was the deciding person. And on December 13th, 2007, the judge agreed with the jury that Paul should be sentenced to death. In fact, the judge was so tiffed, rightfully so, that he spoke for a full 30 minutes while delivering the final sentence. Now, can you imagine getting in trouble and waiting for your sentence and then having to listen through a whole 30-minute lecture? Like, what am I going to get? And probably that is what Paul DeRusso was thinking. Well, part of the judge's statement went like this, quote, "This was a consciously hideous crime. DeRusso is manipulative, devious, and crafty," quote. The judge went on to cite that the brutality of the crime was part of the reason he agreed with the jury's recommendation for the death penalty. Well, of course, with the death penalty, in most cases, come the appeal. Paul's first appeal was filed in 2010. Arguments were made that the similarities between the five other murders were not similar at all, pointing out that each crime scene was different. The cords found around some of the victims' necks were dissimilar in how they were tied or draped, and the trauma that the body sustained were different in each and every case. Because remember, even though Paul was only charged with one murder, the prosecution was allowed to discuss the other uncharged murders to show the similarities. Now, the burden in order to get those into evidence is a little bit different than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Another point made in this appeal was that the collateral crimes, meaning the other five Jacksonville murders, were too remote in time to be related to Tyresa Mack's murder, citing that there were 3.5 years that transpired between Tyresa, Nakia, and Shawanda's cases. Another argument was that the collateral crime evidence should not have been admissible because it was unfairly prejudicial and misled the jury. And yet another argument was made, citing that the collateral evidence, which should have only been a minuscule part of the whole trial, took up 2/3 of the trial time, and the defense argued that it really overwhelmed the issue at hand, which was Tyresa's murder. Concerning the primary and collateral evidence, the defense argued that the prosecution did not properly instruct the jury on the burden of proof between the two. Well, while I read about this case, I thought the defense made valid points and advocated well for their client. But in the end, the appeal was denied in a 5-1 decision. The dissenting judge did not believe that the prosecution met their burden of proving that Paul committed the collateral crimes in a clear and convincing manner. Despite winning over one judge in appeal, the verdict and sentence remained guilty, death penalty. But death penalty appeals are never over. Paul's next appeal came in 2012. In this appeal, he first filed a motion for post-conviction relief, but abandoned that before the hearing. The other appeal claim was that he had ineffective assistance of counsel. When all else fails, this is the go-to appeal, everyone. This appeal focused on two things. One, why had the defense not requested more physical and psychiatric testing of their client? And two, why had the defense been so lax during voir dire when they were picking jury members? Well, while the appeal sat on the court's docket, some big news came out of the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court had decided that Florida's death penalty sentencing statute violated the Sixth Amendment because it did not call for a unanimous vote. If you remember, Paul was sentenced to death by a 10-2 vote by the jury, not a unanimous vote. The appeals team immediately filed a supplemental briefing arguing that his death sentence should be vacated. Well, the Florida Supreme Court decided on the original appeal, denying that there was any ineffective assistance of counsel. But they still had to decide on the additional filing. And ultimately, with the Supreme Court's decision, the Florida Supreme Court's hands were tied. So they vacated Paul DeRusso's sentence and ordered a new sentence hearing. Paul had another day in sentencing court, but that didn't take place until 2021. After presenting all of the sentencing evidence to a fresh new jury, they returned a 10-2 decision voting for death. Since it was a split decision, Paul was automatically sentenced to life in prison. Paul was never tried or sentenced for the other five Jacksonville murders or for Tracy Habersham's murder in Georgia. But the story doesn't end there. After Paul's crimes came to light, German authorities began to look into some of their unsolved murders, and the German government suspects that Paul DeRusso is responsible for several murders that occurred in their country while Paul DeRusso was stationed there with the army. Before I end, I wanted to remember Paul's known victims. This is just a little information about these women whose lives were cut tragically short. Tracy Denise Habersham was born on September 27, 1979, in Swainsboro, Georgia, to her parents Louise Smith Habersham and Ronald Habersham. Her father was an army veteran. She also left behind her brother, who was sweet enough to drive her wherever she needed to go. Tyresa Mack was 24 years old and the mother of three young sons. She was trying to better her life and was applying for jobs when she was murdered. Along with her sons, she left behind a grieving family who loved her very much. Nicole Williams was just 18 years old when she died. She was described by her grandmother as a very sweet person who was always happy. Nicole was still in high school and wanted to go to beauty school to become a hairdresser. 19-year-old Nakia Chanel Kilpatrick left behind two sons and was pregnant with her third baby at the time of her death. Shawanda Denise McAllister was 20 years old and engaged to be married. She was pregnant with her fiancé's baby when she died. Shawanda was working as a nursing assistant and eventually wanted to train to become a nurse. Sarita Ann Cohen would have turned 20 years old in 2003, the year she was murdered. She left behind her heartbroken mother. Giovanna Tyrica Jefferson was the youngest victim at just 17 years old. People recalled her having a warm heart, a lovely smile, and she will be missed by her family and friends. True Crime Army, I just want to say thank you so much for choosing to listen to Military Murder today. Your support means the world to me. If you're interested in supporting the show in other ways, please check out patreon.com/militarymurder to check out ways that you can support the show while getting access to extra stories. This episode was researched and written by one of our very own listeners and fan club members, Myrtle. The sources for this episode include Ledger Inquirer, News4JAX, Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times, Pensacola News Journal, WFMY News 2, Florida Today, Tampa Tribune, Court Listener, Death Penalty Information Center, Florida Department of Corrections, Supreme Court of Florida, and Midland Daily News. Military Murder is a Mama Margot production. The music was created by Ty Ops. Until next time, remember, you never really know what someone is capable of, so remain vigilant always. You have a fabulous week, and I'll keep digging to bring you another Military Murder story next week.
Mama's working on her podcast.
I don't want to.